just about 3 weeks ago, since some of you have not went out there, the Mishnah says, any one who teaches his daughter Torah as if he's teaching her lewdness. And in Yerushalmi, they tell a story of Matrona Sha'alad Rabbi Elazar of Neyma, Keita Chaka Maaseh Ha'egel, Mehen Meitim Shalosh Mitot. Why were the three different measures of death inflicted on those people who were sinned in the sin of the Egel? Amar La Ein Chachma Pach Shel Isha Ela Vapilcha. The only wisdom of a woman isn't spinning. You shouldn't ask questions about things involving the Torah.
Can I bring something at the Dayanu?
Go ahead.
Would you help me to buy?
Great. Go ahead.
He says just like not only did Rory or Rabbi Chaninovich try to his daughter express independent opinions about a halakha, another Jewish matron held her ground against Rabbi Eliezer in an argument about a gora. That was in
the Yerushalmi that we just quoted.
Right. Sum up the matter, we may refer to the opinion of Ben Azai. Quote, a person should teach his daughter
the Torah. That's the minority opinion. That's Ben Azai's opinion.
We never hear that one.
We heard it last time.
What, I got to have repeat. See, I didn't see that one.
Right.
That's in the...
Right. The halakha is not like Ben Azai.
Yeah, but all right. So this is...
There was a minority opinion that says that...
How do you know how minority he was? Maybe he was a pretty good size minority.
It may very well have been, but the halakha is definitely not like Ben Azai. The Bavli completely rejects Ben Azai's opinion. And the only justification that the Mishnah gives to Ben Azai is that Hayav Adam L'Lameh B'et Mito Torah. So let's read the entire statement of Ben Azai.
Yeah, afterwards. I didn't bring it up.
Mikan Amar Ben Azai Hayav Adam L'Lameh B'et Mito Torah She'im Kisteh Kedash Azchut Tolam. The only reason... The reason that a man should teach his daughter Torah is that if she commits adultery and undergoes the test of the Sota and is not found immediately guilty, that's because she has some virtues which postpone the judgment. So therefore, in order not to have an adulterous daughter suspect that the test of the Sota water is ineffective, Ben Azai commends that you should teach her at least enough that she should know, as far as the laws of Sota, that she can get a delay in execution. So Ben Azai's opinion isn't all that pro women's education.
But
in any event,
she should know Lishma because it implies that she has a comprehension. But a second look shows that the woman did understand what was being said. Lishma, I guess, implies comprehension.
In any event, there's a dispute between
your class.
That's fine. I have very much respect for Gedalia alone, but basically that's an apologetic position there because, first of all, Ben Azai is not all that pro-women's education, at least the way the Bavli interprets him. And secondly, the halakha isn't like Ben Azai. In fact, the most liberal opinion amongst the Rishonim is that of the Rambam, which I'll reread to you. Rambam says, Isha shalamda Torah, yesh laschar. A woman who does study Torah gets a reward. Aval lo aval eino kischar ha'ish. But her reward is not as much as the comparable reward. Female salary is not as high as the male salary. Mepnei shelo nitztaveh. Because a woman is not commanded to study Torah. And anyone who undertakes a duty voluntarily, one that he's not commanded to perform, his reward is not commensurate, is not the same as the reward of someone who's commanded.
Ella papo. Somebody volunteered.
I don't argue with me. And this is a general principle that the schar of someone who's commanded to do a mitzvah is greater than a...
Why does it say that only men should
learn? Not a tennis player, the Akal-Pi-Shi-Yesh-La-Skar, even though a woman does get star for studying Torah, Sivu Chachamim, the Chazal commanded, Shelo Yelameid Adam Et Bito Torah, a man should not teach his daughter Torah, Mepnei Sherov HaNashim Ein Da'atam Uchuvenet Lehitlameid. Ela Heim Motziot Divrei Torah LeDivrei Havai L'Kmi Eniyat Da'atam. Since women have a lower mental capacity than men, therefore they would be inclined to misinterpret what they study in the Talmud, and therefore there's a positive command not to teach girls Torah. Amu Chachamim, kol ha-malamed et bito Torah ki ilu limdat tiklo. And he quotes the Mishnah. Lamed dvarim amurim, when is it prohibited? In what circumstances is it prohibited to teach a woman Torah? But Torah she-ba'al peh, to teach a girl Gemara, it's definitely prohibited. Aval Torah she-bechtav, as far as teaching her Bible or Tanakh is concerned, lo yilamed ot lachatchila, a person shouldn't teach her that either, lachatchila. Ve'im limda, however, if you did teach a girl Torah or Tanakh, einokem lamda tiflo, it's not a serious offense. In other words, there's a serious offense involved in teaching a woman Gemara, but there's no such serious offense involved in teaching a woman Tanakh, but it shouldn't be done. That's the Rambam. That's where we sort of ended last time. And now let's read Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is basically a paraphrase of the Rambam. So he accepts this more lenient, more tolerant view of the Rambam. The Rambam's view is that since women have inferior minds, one shouldn't teach them Gemara because it would only confuse them. But you shouldn't teach them Torah or Tanakh, but it's not such a serious offense if you teach them Torah Shebichtav. Isha shalamda Torah yesh la schar. Aval lo kischar ha'ish, mepnei she'eino mitzuvah ha'oseh, ha'oseh. Yachol pi she'yesh la schar tzivu chazal, shelo yilamed et adat ha'bito Torah, מפני שרוב הנשים אין דעתן מכוונת להתלמד, ומוציאות דברי תורה לדברי הווי, לפי עניית דעתן. אמרו חכמים, כל המלמד את ביתו תורה, כאילו מלמדה תפלות. במה דברים בתורה שבעל פה, או תורה שבכתב לא ילמד אותו לכתחילה, ואם מלמדה אינו כמלמדה תפלות. So that's almost an exact quote of the Rambam, except for the little short. Okay, so that's the official position in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, with no deviating position. This is the universal position in
what school did the bar go to with Marion?
They probably went to Harvard.
Yeah. A bit liberal.
Not to the medical school, because the Harvard Medical School didn't admit women until 1945. And they were before that time.
Heard that, yeah. So how did they learn? They didn't know that in the Gemara time?
A good question you should ask the Gemara. I'm just simply stating what the official halachic position is.
I'm looking to see how I can answer these things.
Okay, now, I want to emphasize that this is a clear-cut halacha. It's a clear-cut halacha not to teach women Gemara. It's prohibited. It's advisable not to teach them Torah or Tanakh either, but it's not so serious an offense if you teach them those either. Let me point out that, for example, what about the issue of calling a woman to the Torah? The Gemara says, the Mishnah says, that Isha Olah L'minyan Zayin, Aval It's an insult to the dignity of the tzibur, so therefore it's preferable to not call a woman up to give her an aliyah. However, if you remember, many times we studied this tshuva of the Moran in Rottenberg, which says that be'ir shekula kohanim, if you have a town, remember, in these small towns in Germany, people were all related to one another, so it was quite conceivable that you had a little small hamlet where all of the male members of the town were Kohanim. The Yir Shekula Kohanim, the Ein Ba Yisrael Echad, and there's not even a single Yisrael or a Kohanim. And remember, the law is that you can't call one Kohen up after another, because it seems to indicate that the second fellow really isn't the Kohen, and you're demeaning his lineage. People might suspect that there's some fault in his lineage. Nirali, the Kohen kore pa'amayim, that the Kohen should go take the first aliyah and the second aliyah. V'shuv yikru'u nashim. And the remaining five aliyot should be given to women, as opposed to other Kohen.
I'm a little confused. With their method, you wasn't a feature, I assume, so the women just came to the
second. Came down into the shul, and went up and gave an aliyah. Had an aliyah. V'ir shekula kohanim ve'im v'afilu Yisrael echad, nirau li v'kohen korei pa'amayim, v'shuv yikru nashim, v'ad kol v'ashlimim v'ninim zayim, afilu evet v'shifra v'katan, v'perish Rabbi Simcha Zal, v'lav dafka v'ninim zayim, v'ad ilo afilu l'shlosha, v'nan tfam v'perkim v'nigila korei, katan korei v'nit v'torah, v'nehid v'masikala aval amu chachamim lo tikra ha'isha v'torah m'tnei kadot ha'tzibur. Even though the conclusion was that a woman shouldn't get an aliyah because it's an insult to the community, hecha delo efshar, in a situation like this where the town consists entirely of kohanim and therefore there's no recourse other to call than calling up the women, yinche kodod ha-tzibur mutmei tugam kol ha-kohanim ha-kohanim, it's better to have the kavod of the tzibur rejected instead of questioning the lineage of the Kohanim. Shelo yamru b'nei gerushotein. No one should suspect that these Kohanim, their mothers were divorcees and therefore they're not there. So let's understand this. The prohibition against calling a woman up to the Torah is an issue of kavod ha-tzibur. And the Maharam clearly says that if you had to choose between two evils, namely demeaning the tzibur by calling up a woman, or suggesting that perhaps a Kohen who's called up the Shlishi is somehow has a suspect lineage, it's preferable to call up a woman. And also remember that if the issue is one of kavod ha-tzibur, there are many ways, possibly, theoretically, of getting around that. For example, one might make the claim that nowadays, having the real reason that it's not a kavod ha-tzibur, you're calling up a woman, giving the implication. Remember, in those times, the person who came up to read the Torah actually read the Torah. It wasn't like we have it today, where there's one reader, and a person who's called up to the Torah just makes a block. So the implication of calling up a woman is that the tzibur is insulted, that she's the only one that's literate. There are all these men around who can't read, and you're calling up a woman. That's so the meaning of those. Right. So, secondly, remember, first of all, the issue of kavod ha-tzibur is there's a question in general whether a tzibur can be mochel al kvodo. Some say yes, some say no. But, I mean, normally, if an issue is one of my personal honor, I have the right to give in on that particular issue. Secondly, the notion of kavod ha-tzibur is one of circumstance. In a time when all men and all women are literate, it may no longer be a demeaning to the kavod ha-tzibur. Certainly, it's no less demeaning to the kavod ha-tzibur to have a woman give a dvar Torah at a kiddush than being called up to the Torah, because after all, the woman is showing off her scholarly skills in the presence of men who may not be able to compete with her. So that should be more demeaning to the kavod ha-tzibur than calling up a woman to the Torah. I'm not arguing that we should automatically start to give women aliyos now, but if the rabbi of the young Israel decided that at some moment, the Rabbi Goretz decided that he wanted to call women up to the Torah, it would not be a shocking violation of the halacha. There's no, the prohibition against it, which is certainly bound in tradition, but there's no clear cut. It would be easy for someone to make a ruling which says that this law of not calling giving a woman an aliyah no longer applies. However, the prohibition against teaching women Gemara is clear-cut. This is something that's absolute in the Mishnah, in the Gemara, in the Shulchan Aruch, and in all the posts. And yet, we have the phenomenon that at my Maimonides school, when girls are taught Gemara.
They don't get called up.
Right, I'm saying.
You can't have everything.
The issue of teaching them Gemara is a far more serious violation of written law and traditional law than calling up those Torahs.
Didn't the Papa's plan say the same thing?
No, he never suggested the same thing.
There's a woman over here who wants to
ask. I know the Rav says the people when he gets up to heaven and he's told about it, they don't accept that.
As his punishment.
As punishment.
Right, but okay.
But one more thing that Rebbe said about the question was asked, how do they cross the people about what? A woman can make up. Do you have to be at the Sefer Torah to make the bracha?
You have to be there to read it.
You have to be within the.
You have to be there to read it.
Not just making the bracha, they're reading it.
Right.
Well, they don't know that today. They're talking about, she had a aliyah. That she could be in her. In the,
not
the
that she has to read
to make a bracha.
Not that she has to read it.
No, so they're going to do that today. She's going to read the Sefer Torah.
All right.
Did I say they were going to do that today? All that I said was...
Men don't do it.
All that I'm saying is that as far as technical halacha is concerned, the teaching of girls Gemara is a far more serious violation of the classical, printed, traditional halacha than calling up a woman to the Torah. That's the only statement that I made.
And how come no Orthodox rabbis have the guts to do it?
Well, only one Orthodox rabbi had the guts to teach women Gemara. As far as I know, and that's Rabbi Soloveitchik.
After
that, some came along. But I'm simply saying, I'm not suggesting that one should call women up to the Torah. That's not the matter at issue. The thing that I'm trying to discuss is how is it that end of the 1930s onward, there has been here at the Maimonides School in Boston, and there are women sitting around this table also, which would be a violation. I think you started coming to my shiurim 40 years ago.
No, 25.
Huh? 26. 70s.
30 years old.
I thought, weren't you when you were an undergraduate?
No.
I see. All right.
I thought I was being discouraged when I was an undergraduate. You know, when I went to Yeshiva at the time, I was attending Gemara. This was in New Jersey.
Yeah, that was after Rabbi Soloveitchik introduced this revolution here in Boston. That was 1917. Also, right. Only until 1970.
Yeah.
So we have to understand what happened in the 19th century to cause this drastic change.
Excuse me. I have two questions about the
moment. No, what was happened in the 19th century. And what happened in the 20th century was 1917 and thereabouts was a reaction to things that were happening in the 19th century in Eastern Europe.
Woman can go up and climb out of the Torah without getting an aliyah.
She can go no matter from where she is.
But they're going up usually.
No, they're going
up.
They stay
up
from behind
her.
Okay.
Wait a minute, there's a question to Mara.
Yes?
First question is, and this is ignorance, but why shouldn't the Kohen get all seven aliyahs? One Kohen. Well, I mean, that would have been an alternative solution.
That's not what he suggested.
And the other solution would, I know, but... Okay. And presumably at that time, they weren't actually reading the...
I don't know what their custom was.
So, well...
In any event, all I'm simply pointing out is that something that would be taken as a shocking thing, Mr. Weinstein would not stand for calling up a woman to the Torah in the Maimonides Shul.
I don't care. I'm doing that. Well,
he'll just leave out.
call him up at the seminary.
Okay,
I posed
the problem. The problem is, what actually happened? Why is it so that there was such a drastic change, first the founding of the Beis Yaakov movement in 1917, and then the decision of Rabbi Soloveitchik here in Boston to actually teach girls Gemara, which goes in the face, flies in the face of all traditional thinking.
Probably because women were allowed to attend colleges.
But the story is long and complicated, and I hope that we will come to some understanding of this tonight and in a week from tonight, but we pose the problem. Let me first go back and actually read the Shulchan Aruch on the Hilchos Talmud Torah from the beginning of that section, rather than not just the issue of women's education. Kol Ish Yisrael Chayav the Talmud Torah Bein Ani Bein Ashir, all Jewish males are obligated to study Torah, whether rich or poor, ben shalem begufo, ben bal yisuin, ben bachur, ben zakein, whether healthy or a man is in constant pain, whether he's young or whether he's very old. Afilu ani hamachazer al aptachim, even a beggar who goes around to collect money for himself. Ashnor, afilu bal yishol banim, even a man who's married and has a large family. Hayav lekvolo zman l'talmud Torah v'yom b'layla, sh'nehema v'higita bo yomam b'layla. The Rama adds, "Uvishat adchak, a man is under serious pressure. Afilu lo kara rak kriyash mashachrit v'yavdid lo yamush mipicha karinit." He fulfills his minimal obligation by saying Krishna in the morning and in the evening. Umishi iyashar lo lo, but neshe eno yodei aklal lo lo. A person who can't study because he's just completely ignorant. Or mitnehat yodol shiyesh lo, if or because he's under heavy medical practice and he just can't get away. Yaspik la'acherim halomdin. He should provide financial support to others who will study. Yilmod adam Torah ve'achar kach yisa isha. A person should study Torah and then get married. She'im yisa isha k'chila, because if he would first get married, yi'efshar lo la'asot b'Torah me'achar sh'reichayim b'tzavaro. Because the grinding stone is hanging around his neck, he will therefore not be able to study. But if a man cannot survive without a woman, because he is tormented by sexual impulses, under those circumstances, it's better to marry her. Right, but you will see that in fact the practice in Eastern Europe was to marry much younger. It's going to be one of the contributing factors to things that were happening. Ad eimotai chayav lumod, until when should a person study Torah? Ad yom moto, until the day of his death, shenemar ten yasu mevo kol yimei chayev. The kol zman shelo yasok b'Torah hu shokeach. And if you don't continue to study, you will forget what happened before.
Who are you reading?
The Shulchan Aruch, your deus and rei member. Chayav adam l'shalesh limuda. A person must divide his study into thirds. Shlish v'torah shebiktav, tahenu ha'arba avi esfim. In other words, a third of his time should be devoted to studying Tanakh. Shlish v'mishnah, a third of his time should be devoted, tahenu toresh ba'alpeh. U'peirush torah shebiktav b'klavzeh. In other words, a third of his time should be devoted to studying Mishnah and Gemara. The shlish b'talmud t'ahenu shiyadim yaskel achrit davar mirishuto yotzi davar mitoch davar yedmet davar v'davar yadun b'milom shatorah nedreshet v'hem ad shiyedah hek ikar ha-mitzvot tehek yotzei ha-yisur ha-mutar yotzei b'zeh davar shalomen b'pnei ha-shmua keitzad ha-yob ha-umut if a man was an artisan ba-osek b'machkel shalosh sha'ot v'yom and he just devotes 3 hours of the day to his work the Tisha B'Torah, and 9 hours a day are devoted to study. Koreh Shalosh Mehem B'Torah Shebiktav. He should then spend 3 hours studying Torah Shebiktav. V'Shalosh Sheta B'Torah Shebaalpeh. V'Shalosh Yavin Davar Mitok Torah. Davar Mitok Torah. B'Med Varim Amurim. What does this refer to? V'Tchilat Limudo Shel Adam. When a man is starting out on his studies. Aval Kashiyigdol B'Torah. V'Lo Yiyei Tzarech L'Mod Torah Shebiktav. When he no longer needs to review the Tanakh, and furthermore, he doesn't have to spend his time reviewing the Mishnah and the Gemara, he should spend some time each day reviewing these two items. However, the majority of his day, according to the breadth of his understanding and his mental skills. Now this is the Shulchan Aruch. The Rama adds to this, V'yesh omrim, some say, Sheba Talmud Bavli, that if you study the Talmud Bavli, Shuhu Balul v'mikra v'mishnah v'gemara, which has a mixture of both mikra, mishnah, and gemara, Adam yotzei yedei chavotah v'shvil hakol. That you don't have to study Torah or the Tanakh, and you don't have to study Mishnah. It's enough to study Gemara, because the Gemara includes everything. This is the Tzur B'Shem Rabbeinu Tam. Okay? And unfortunately, it was this last opinion that drove the educational system in Eastern Europe up through more or less the end of the 19th century. And so, in other words, although all Jewish men were literate, if you define literacy by the ability to read, that is, to mouth Hebrew words, I would not say that most Jewish men were literate in the sense of being able to understand Hebrew texts, or be able to write in Hebrew, or be able to study Gemara. That only fell to a minority because of the nature of the elementary educational system as it existed in Eastern Europe. In other words, it's a standard statement that all Jewish men were literate and only a fraction of Jewish women were literate, but one has to take that with a grain of salt, because if you define literacy to be anything more than simply meaning being able to mouth the words in order to be able to say the prayers, then it is not true that most Jewish men were literate in the sense that they were able to... a typical Jewish man in Europe, for example, would probably be no more able to compose a lengthy letter in Hebrew than the people sitting around this table. All of us sitting around this table have occasion to write letters or articles or something, but I doubt whether most of us would be capable of, without some assiduous help or effort, to write in Hebrew as fluently as they could write in English.
Are you saying that these men were obligated to study Gemara, but could read the
Aramaic? I'm saying that a small fraction of the people that finished the elementary education, which was relatively brief, some percentage of those men went on to the Gemara Cheder. And among those, they were able to read and understand the Gemara, the good ones. But they were never completely literate, say, in Hebrew. Let me describe the Hebrew educational system.
That's the Hebrew. Let's come back to the Gemara. There's a specific language, and there's a discussion of give and take.
Mm-hmm. They would understand that, but they would not, for example, would not be able, for example, to read, know anything about Hebrew grammar, and they would not, for example, be able to read. Okay. Read Yeshayahu or Yirmiyahu or any biblical text, or something like that.
Well, but you're claiming that they would have been able to understand what prayers meant.
No.
That's different from mouthing words.
No, I don't think they would understand what the prayers meant. I think they would be able to mouth the prayers.
But they would be able to understand the discussion of the Gemara.
Those who got to the stage of Gemara.
Oh.
It would be like saying someone got to high school, say, in the 19th century in the United States. A small percentage did.
Okay.
All right?
But most prayer book are translated anyway.
But they couldn't read. What would they be translated into?
The language where they live. Hungarian, Poland.
They did not read those languages. Let me read various texts before I get onto the main text, which I'm going to rely on, which is this excellent book by Iris Parush on reading women in the 19th century. I want to read some excerpts from a person who grew up in an Orthodox background, but of course was quite antagonistic to his upbringing in his later life. So I'm going to read some extended sections from this autobiography, Quest, by Leopold Infeld. Infeld was a physicist. He wrote a relatively popular book with Einstein on the basics of physics in the 1930s, and wrote one very good paper with Einstein, which I use all the time. But he was not one of the world's great physicists. I would say he was sort of a second or a third rate physicist, but his life was saved by Einstein several times. He's writing this autobiography at the end of 1941, just about after the German invasion of Poland. So I was sort of, the scenes melted slowly away, but I knew that they would return again and again through my conscious thought and unconscious dreams. Millions of people killed in China, thousands of children starved in Madrid, Jews in Poland flogged and executed. In a few weeks I shall lecture 2 hours a week on the theory of relativity and drink orange juice for breakfast. Millions of people were killed in China. I nearly went to China for a professorship just before the war with Japan started. Wasn't I lucky? Thousands of children starved in Madrid. Some years ago, I was recommended by Einstein for a professorship in Madrid. I nearly went there. In London, I had a conference with the Spanish ambassador in which he described vividly to me the beauties of his country. Before the formalities were completed, Spain was drowned in blood. I escaped the horrors of the siege of Madrid. Again, I was lucky. Jews in Poland flogged and executed. 3 years have passed since, by superposition of strange accidents, I left Poland temporarily. A year later, the way back was closed. I had escaped from the greatest of all horrors. These associations, binding the fate of nations to my own ego, were as natural and as human as cowardice and the instinct of self-preservation. They may be smug and low, but they're common to all, nearly all of us. To save our faces and to clear our consciences, we give money to causes, showing our sympathy by putting on sad expressions or making rash speeches. I grew up in a world which is being destroyed. Through my whole life, I fought the dark, narrow atmosphere of the ghetto in which I was born. Throughout my life, I began to see it melted by the progress of passing time. Never did I think that the destruction might be accomplished suddenly by one blow of an armed fist governed by hate. Never shall I see the buildings and the shops and the bearded faces and the dirt of the street. Never shall I greet my old friends with a smile which erects a bridge over passing time. Once I knew that my longing for my hometown, for the sound of my native language, would always be in me, but that it would be softened by the knowledge that a return was possible, that I should be able to throw one more glance at the world of my past, which I despised and loved. There's no return now. My pictures will become shadows, the background darker, and the features less distinct with every day. I shall never be able to test them with reality and to prolong their endurance. Not long ago, the world of my memories was still as real and existent as a postage stamp on a letter that comes across the ocean. This world is now strangled and driven to a sudden death. Rows of soldiers, guns, and a stream of blood lie between me and the world of my youth. I must revive the shadows of my memory before they disappear into the dark background, before I begin to doubt that this world ever existed. I must throw one more look upon the image of the path which led me to the present day. And Andy Stark's autobiography. When I was five, this is, I think, in the year 1902, when I was five, I was sent to a Jewish school. The room was small, the benches narrow, hard and painfully uncomfortable. We boys sat so near to each other that our arms overlapped and each was pressed by his neighbor. In a singing chorus, we repeated the letters of the Hebrew alphabet again and again until we recognized them. Then came the combination of consonants and vowels. We repeated mechanically until the letters in the book created the right nervous reaction and the proper sounds came automatically. The windows of the room were closed. They will remain so for the whole winter, otherwise the cold might come in. The air is heavy and odorous. The smell of potatoes and onions cooked by the teacher's wife enters the already foul air of our room from the neighboring kitchen. Our teacher carries a stick and is dressed in a long, filthy silk suit worn by Orthodox Jews in Krakow. Each of us boys is about 5 years old. The teacher listens to our singing chorus. His trained ear catches a voice that is off-key. Slowly, with his stick raised, he comes nearer to the place from which he can reach me. The suspense grows, and I try to sing as loudly and correctly as I can. I am saved. The stick falls heavily on the back of my neighbor. The chorus, guided by the voice of our teacher, repeats with greater intensity our monotonous song. The beaten boy dries out his tears with his elbow, and the teacher looks for another victim. Every morning, when lessons are over, the teacher and his helper take us back in groups to our homes. They collect us again for the afternoon. Each morning and each afternoon, we breathe together the same air, repeat and repeat, until we can read the meaningless words of the holy language in which God converses with the angels. We read words which we do not understand. We read them slowly, making mistakes and fewer mistakes until we read them fluently. The first step of our education is finished. My education was determined by the old rules of the ghetto. A small part of Krakow. Remember that Dick Pipes maintained that there was never any such thing as a ghetto in Poland. It was an island surrounded by a strange world. Outside were Babel, the castle of the Polish kings, full of memories of past splendors, wars, and love affairs. The simple and impressive Gothic church of St. Mary, which with its two towers dominated the town from the old market, where the peasants sold food and flowers. The Jagiellonian library and its courtyard with curved arches built on the most noble Renaissance style, narrow streets, houses, churches, and public buildings which had stood for centuries. All this was outside the ghetto, outside the district Kazimierz, named so in memory of the great Polish king who preserved peace, had a love-pet affair with a beautiful Jewess, and 5 centuries ago opened the doors of his kingdom to the persecuted Jews expelled from Italy, Spain, and Germany. There, in Kazimierz, in Krakow's ghetto, 30,000 Jews, squeezed into a small district, breathed the air in which the smell of poverty was mingled with the poetry of religious ecstasy. The Polish city of Krakow, ruled in the time of my childhood by the Austrian Emperor Franz Josef I, was far removed from the Jewish ghetto. The distance was much greater than the 4,000 miles which now divide me from my hometown. To the ghetto Jew, the Polish city was a strange and hostile world. The distance could be covered in 10 minutes' walk, but the two worlds were separated in thoughts and ideas by the chasm of centuries. They faced each other in mutual ignorance, scorn, and hate. The separating wall was built by religious prejudice, language difference, and mistrust. Here, in this ghetto, at the beginning of the 20th century, I began my preliminary studies, arranged and conducted according to tradition established hundreds of years before. The new century was 2 years old, as was the quantum theory, which marks the beginning of modern physics. In the old days, Jews studied their Bible and their Talmud, lived and died in their ghetto, and produced many learned rabbis. They did not want and they did not need to know the language of the country. Many of them never saw a Gentile, but even if they did had seen one, why should they speak to him? They talk amongst themselves in Yiddish and trade in Hebrew. A Jewish shoemaker in the ghetto made shoes for Jews. A Jewish shopkeeper in the ghetto sold to Jews and bought from Jews. The ghetto formed an isolated system. Its inhabitants studied the great books of Jewish learning and kept aloof from the outside world. For the Jews in the Krakow ghetto, the world was divided into 3 compartments. One was for Jews. They were held together by their religion, synagogue, dress, and language. And the second compartment was the great unknown, the Gentiles. The less one knew about them, the better. They had been invented as a punishment for Jewish sins by the God who knows and remembers everything and punishes sons for the sins of their fathers up to the 7th generation. The 3rd compartment was reserved for 1 man only. He was above the Jews and the Gentiles. He was the Emperor Franz Josef I, blessed by prayers each month when the rim of the moon first appeared in the heavens. A just old man who liked the Jews, he was neither Gentile nor Jew, but apart from and above everything. It was he to whom God had given the greatest power in the world, and his picture was engraved on each piece of money earned in hard labor and spent with great reluctance. The compartments must be kept separate, especially the compartment for the Jewish and Gentile worlds. But for some strange reason, the emperor wanted the compartments to be less distinct and decided that all his subjects, and therefore Jews too, must have a 4-year secular education in 3 Austrian schools. The Jews did not like the emperor's decision. The emperor himself spoke the German language, similar to Yiddish. Every Jew can understand German because he understands Yiddish. He can even speak German by speaking a properly spoiled Yiddish. But Krakow public schools taught Polish and not German because Austria left the Polish language in the schools when it grabbed Poland. So the Jews had to learn a foreign language, a difficult and unnecessary task, perhaps even a simple one. Let me skip a bit, so I don't want to read the whole book. Yes. Thus, I was sent to public school when I was 6 years old. At this time, I could already read Hebrew. My parents did what all other parents in the ghetto did. They sent me to public school in the morning and to Jewish school in the afternoon. My parents lived on the periphery of the ghetto, in Kazimierz, but near to districts partially Gentile. They felt superior to the inhabitants of the inner ghetto who lived the same life as had their ancestors. My parents approved of mild, slow progress. They drew their religious line in a well-defined way. They were proud both of the progress they had achieved and the traditions they had preserved. What they really did, like all groups inside the ghetto, was to mix their own religious cocktails, convinced that their mixture was the most tasty to God and man, and any deviation to the left was against the essential religious rules, and any deviation to the right, uncivilized and superstitious religious exaggeration. Sound familiar? Life.
Where are the girls?
Life forced them. I don't want to discuss girls quite yet. Life forced them to take this stand and to defend it. If the Jewish religion is taken literally, it becomes a sin to breathe without at the same time contemplating the greatness of God. A man wants to earn his daily bread. A man who wants to earn his daily bread is forced by life to cut out some portion of the religious prescriptions, and will try to find justification for his own delusion. This is what my parents did.
My mother was the first in her family who did not cut her hair and wear a wig after marriage. My father was the first in his family to wear European dress. He refused to wear the silk overcoat with a fur collar and a satin cap with 13 small fur tails, which religious Jews in Krakow wore each Saturday. Once having made a choice of rules for himself, however, he clung to them consistently. His habits, rules of behavior, and details of everyday life and dress were all well organized. He always rose early in the morning, went to synagogue to say his morning prayers, came home for breakfast to eat the same food at the same hour, and went to his shop to work. And now let me describe, skip to his description of his later schooling.
So he went to cheder and then he went to
48. And then he went to preschool in the morning and then cheder in the afternoon, like the day school here. Okay. In the afternoon, I had to study the Bible in a more advanced Jewish school. My father brought me to the schoolmaster, a man with a severe face, a long gray beard, and an extended belly. In his hand, he carried a short cane. He looked me over gravely in front of his assembled class, then opened the Hebrew book and let me read. Satisfied with my knowledge, he took me to his helper, from whom I was up to obtain some individual tutoring before I could join the advanced class. This was the unbreakable rule. The helper was a young man with a small black beard and a pockmarked face. He put the holy book of the Bible on the table, opened it a worn out and dirty page, and placed a wooden pointer with a sharp end above a certain Hebrew word and commanded, "Read this." Slowly, I read the word. "Repeat." I repeated, "Repeat," I repeated. So it went five times. Then he said a German Yiddish word, followed by the same command, "Repeat." I repeated obediently. After five repetitions, I knew both words by heart, not understanding either of them. Remember, the Yiddish Teich was written in ancient Yiddish, which was incomprehensible to the students, in contrast to their spoken Yiddish. These were two words, but I got the idea. These were two words in two different languages. They didn't convey any meaning to me, but I knew that they were bound together by the magic equivalence relation. This pointer jumped to the next word. The method began to make sense. So after a few repetitions, a new German Yiddish, soon after a few repetitions, a new German Yiddish word would be thrown in. I would have to catch it quickly like a ball and repeat it five times. The wooden pointer moved slowly along the line, then down to the next and the next. In his other hand, the teacher carried a stick, but he saw from the flow of the lesson that the stick might be unnecessary. So he put it carefully on the table, and having freed his one hand, he started to pick his nose slowly, thoroughly, and with dignity. Only years later, I found out what I was supposed to have been doing. I was learning by heart and translating into obscure words the following passage from the Bible. And the Lord called unto Moses, and spake unto him out of the tabernacle of the congregation, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, If any man of you bring an offering unto the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the cattle, even of the herd, and of the flock. If the offering be a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own voluntary will at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Lord. And he shall put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and he then shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. And he shall kill the bullock before the Lord, and the priests, Aaron's son, shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood round. Why did my education of the Bible start with these words? Because this old custom must be obeyed by all the children of Israel. And Jews have for it, as for everything else, a rational explanation. It's even very simple. There obviously cannot be a better and more innocent deed than the bringing of offerings to the Almighty God. Nor can there be anything more innocent than young, unspoiled children who have not had the opportunity to commit sin. When offerings are innocent and the children innocent, is it not right that the two should meet as soon as possible? In other words, he's describing what was an additional education, which was they started with Vayechol. And the children, most of them, didn't understand the words either in English or in Yiddish, but were educated to, in Hebrew or in Yiddish, and they were educated, therefore, to memorize, be able to read the words in Hebrew, memorize the Ivritaych, which was in an ancient Yiddish that they didn't understand, and that's how the, say, six-year-old child was starting to learn Chumash. A little later, what happened was that they would be reading the Parshas HaShavuot, which meant that after, when they graduated to Gemara, they would study Parshas HaShavua, which meant that they got from the beginning of the Parsha, maybe to Sheni, or maybe a little bit further, also, mostly without any comprehension. And this was the educational system for boys. Of course, some of them managed to graduate to the level in which they would understand the Gemara, but understanding the Bible was something which was not part of the educational system. So I just wanted you to get a sort of biased, negative opinion by an intelligent observer.
It's hard to pinpoint Jewish creative genius in this system.
How long is it?
Huh?
How long is it?
I would imagine probably until Bar Mitzvah. But he didn't go on to become a serious Gemara student, which was only a minority of the population.
What happened to the girls in that world?
What happened to the girls? Well, that's the subject.
You know how they sing when they start to read? After the singing, you mentioned in the beginning, Komatsa Lavu, Komatsa Isbu.